Production support for Earth Eats comes from the Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
I didn't have an investigative team. I didn't have a data team or all the things that people now have at newspapers. And I mostly bumbled my way through dumpster diving and getting moles in kitchens to feed me invoices and that kind of thing.
This week, Laura Riley, food critic for the Tampa Bay Times, talks with Alex Chambers about her groundbreaking work exposing fraudulent claims in the world of farm-to-table dining. And Jackie B. Howard joins us with her nourishing smoothie bowl recipe to keep you on track or get you back on track with those New Year's resolutions. Coming up in the next half hour on Earth Eats. First, let's check in with Alex Chambers with the news. Hi, Alex. What's up?
Hi, Kate. Did you know flour is a raw food?
I'd never really thought about it that way, but yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Right. We don't usually think about the bags of flour on our pantry shelves as having much in common with raw meat. But a recent recall puts that in a new perspective. On January 23rd, General Mills triggered a voluntary recall of gold medal unbleached flour with a better if used by date of April 20th, 2020. That's 4/20/2020. The company urged customers to check pantries and discard any 5-pound bags with that date. Flour used as an ingredient in foods cooked at a high enough temperature to kill bacteria like salmonella would likely be safe, but cookie dough or other raw products could be dangerous. There have not been any reports of illness from contaminated flour in the recall. There have been a number of flour recalls in the past few years. In 2016, General Mills issued a 45 million pound flour recall due to an E. coli outbreak that infected more than 60 people. Last March, King Arthur Flour recalled more than 6,000 cases of coconut flour contaminated with salmonella. Salmonella infection can cause severe diarrhea, abdominal cramps, and fever 12 to 72 hours after eating contaminated food. General Mills urges consumers in general to eat only cooked flour and to thoroughly clean cooking surfaces that come in contact with raw flour. The FDA adds that consumers should not eat or play with raw dough. Because flour is not treated to remove pathogens during milling, raw flour can contain harmful bacteria. For details about the particular product in the recall, visit our website at eartheats.org. Now that the U.S. government has reopened, farmers are once again able to enroll in vital safety net programs. That includes the Market Facilitation Program for growers who've been financially impacted by the ongoing trade war. Ron Farmer of Greeley, Colorado, says he couldn't sell his grain until the government reopened because he needed to report how much he'd harvested in order to qualify for payments.
Well, the government shut down. These guys weren't here. So I am now in the extension to try to report my production.
Farmers are also starting to enroll in programs under the 2018 Farm Bill that were delayed due to the shutdown. Thanks to our own Chad Bouchard and Esther Honig at Harvest Public Media for those stories.
Thank you, Alex. In a community the size of Bloomington, Indiana, it's easy to take for granted the homespun sincerity of our farmers market. In our market, the folks handing you the ears of sweet corn or the heirloom tomatoes you just selected, they're often the ones who planted the seeds and weeded the beds, harvested the fruit, and also the ones that packed it into the pickup truck that morning before market. Our farmers market has a stringent verification process. The food farmers sell at market has to be grown on their own land, and many of the growers invite customers out for farm visits. You get the chance to know your farmer, and in many cases, to see for yourself where your food comes from. Our guest this week had a different experience in Tampa Bay, Florida. Laura Riley is the food critic for the Tampa Bay Times, A couple of years ago, she started wondering about some of the sourcing of the foods offered in the stalls of open-air markets, as well as the menus in some of her favorite restaurants. Laura Riley visited the IU campus in the fall as part of the IU Food Institute's speaker series, and she stopped by the Earth Eats studio to talk with Alex Chambers about her work.
Welcome to Earth Eats.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. I wanted to start off with the investigation into food fraud. What got you started on that, and then what did you end up finding?
So I'd been thinking for a number of years that I was being lied to, and that I'll tell you the small ways, you know, the kind of like everyone, all the restaurants claim this is a house-made dessert. And it's like, I know that dessert. I have seen that dessert come off the back of the Sysco truck. And you kind of think those type of lies are benign. You know, they're kind of white lies in the scheme of things. But I started seeing it with the advent of kind of farm-to-table restaurants, more pernicious lies that were misrepresentations of farmers' work, essentially, or I suspected as much. So I had been talking, I'd been kind of haranguing, I guess, the paper for a while. I'd said a number of times that I thought, I think there's something here. And my editor, or my editor's editor, basically said, you know, Riley, bring us one thing and we'll talk. So I went to one of my favorite restaurants, a restaurant I'd reviewed really favorably, and I just took a picture of their chalkboard. And, you know, it was like, one of those hipster multicolored chalkboards. I brought it back to the office and I started calling the farmers listed, or the farmers or food producers listed on the list, or on the chalkboard. And the first one I called, it was the grouper and snapper at the restaurant where they were purportedly caught by Captain Kirk Morgan. That was his name. And I was kind of like, do I call this guy Captain Kirk or do I call him Captain Morgan? And either way, it's terrible. So I called up Captain Kirk and said, hey, I want to talk to you about your relationship with this restaurant, Boca. And he said, what's a Boca? And I said, well, you're a commercial fisherman, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, so you must sell to, or you must maybe through a middleman sell to this restaurant, your snapper and grouper. And he's like, well, that's impossible because I don't catch snapper and grouper. I catch mullet and sheep's head, you know, very different species. And I said, well, how could this have happened? So we talked for a few more minutes and then the guy said, wait a second. I was at Icy Sharks, which is this big kind of retail and wholesale fish market. I was at Icy Sharks and a chef stopped me and asked me what I caught, and we exchanged business cards. So I honestly think what was happening was that this chef at this restaurant had a file drawer full of business cards of farmers, and, you know, and it was like a game of Mad Libs. So he basically would fill the chalkboard up with all the business card names in his file drawer. So I went to the paper and I said, I have proof that at least this restaurant that I suspected as much of is misrepresenting what's on their, you know, their farm to table items on their list. And they said, well, go ahead. We'll give you a couple months off of your regular duties and bring us back a story. And so I didn't have an investigative team. I didn't have a data team or all the things that people now have at newspapers. And I mostly bumbled my way through dumpster diving and getting moles in kitchens to feed me invoices and that kind of thing. And, you know, eventually kind of had a critical mass of stuff that I'd found out. Then I kept the scale of it hyper-local and very small. And I think it actually had more impact that way, because I think everybody at that moment, once it went online, people nationally were all saying, yeah, I think that's happening here where I am, too. So it was an interesting moment, I think, you know, to do something that was very, very local that resonated with people in all different parts of the country.
And you started with restaurants, but then you also moved to looking at farmers markets.
Well, farmers markets, I was from Northern California and moved to Florida and wondered why the farmers markets had no farmers at them. That was a mysterious development, and that it was clear there were a lot of outdoor markets. I mean, I hate to even call them farmers markets, outdoor markets, where in Florida you could buy apples and asparagus and things that flagrantly don't grow in the state of Florida. And I thought, well, this is another area where I don't know if they're doing anything illegal or really even immoral, but it certainly seems in poor taste to have a reseller kiosk right next to a legitimate, you know, small-scale farmer who's struggling and, you know, doing all the delivery and marketing and all the things himself. It seems like a surefire way to kill off a lot of small farmers. For that part of the story, I would basically, I used the wonderful world of Facebook. So I would go to these people's Facebook pages, figure out where their farm was, and just drive there on a Sunday morning and surprise them. You know, like we basically, me and a photographer would like show up at people's front doors and they'd be in their pajamas. And we'd say like, hey, we tried to call. We're just here to see your animals, or we want to meet your chickens, or whatever it was. And half the time people were happy to have, you know, most farmers are like, come on in. I'm in my pajamas, but, you know, you're welcome to see my chickens. And half of them mysteriously didn't have anything planted or were in transition with the farm or, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was a pretty mixed bag.
So where is this coming from?
Well, I think, first of all, there are more and more people all the time that are interested in the provenance of their food. And some of that is because they want to be gourmands and just, you know, fresh food, fresh local food tastes better, you know, if it travels, you know, shorter distances. Some people, it's very fear-based. You know, people want to understand the food, the origins of their food, because they're afraid of what that food could do to them, you know. And sometimes it's people want to keep the money in the local economy. You know, there are a lot of different ways that people get to this idea of wanting local or sustainable food. And it's certainly easier to tell someone you're doing it than to actually do it, you know. And I think we just don't have the infrastructure in terms of policing at the local, state, or federal level to really crack down on fraud.
So about the policing, what can we do about this? You've said consumers need to make more of an effort, push harder at farmers markets, I think, at restaurants, to ask about where their food is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, wouldn't it be better to have more regulators?
Well, any change happens either bottom up or top down, right? And it's a situation, I think, in this case, where both could potentially be effective. If we kind of demand that legislators take a look at some of this stuff, that is one avenue. And I'll tell you, in the state of Florida, I went to the Commissioner of Agriculture and told him about this problem and said, this is serious. What are you going to do about it? And he was utterly unruffled by the prospect of people misrepresenting at farmers markets. He was saying, you know, this is a guy who wanted to be governor and has a long history, many generations in ag in Florida. So has a vested interest in Florida farmers, you know, and that's kind of always been part of his platform. But for him, it was more important to get farmers markets, or let's just call them outdoor markets, in places that were, you know, food deserts, to get wholesome food into those places was more important than to drill down on, are they farmers or are they resellers? And I get that. I totally understand that. I think that's a legitimate argument. He had other fish to fry. But I think there are other subtle ways of demanding change. You know, for instance, the state of Florida has about 40 seafood festivals every year. These are huge draws, huge tourist draws. People come from, you know, some of them, it's, you know, 140,000 people come to a town of 20,000 people to go to these festivals. Well, I did another story kind of in this series on that phenomenon. And, you know, these kiosks or these kind of vendors will have the front will say Florida grouper sandwich, $9, or Florida shrimp po' boy, et cetera, et cetera. All you have to do is walk around to the back of the kiosk and there's stacks of boxes of like Vietnamese shrimp and Southeast Asian bassa, which is like a, you know, kind of a bottom feeder fish that is frequently substituted for expensive fish like grouper. It would have been easy to bust these people. Consumers have to exert pressure on whatever bodies do govern those kinds of things. You know, obviously at a federal level, it's, you know, FDA, USDA, but there are state officials, state inspectors that should oversee those kinds of things. You know, they should be more concerned about that than they are.
Have you seen changes happening since the articles came out 2 years ago? Have you seen like ripple effects from them?
Yeah, our state attorney general took a real interest in this. She did initiate this investigation, and there has been some kind of token effort to make people accountable. But I think in any industry, liars will be liars, and so they will amend their behavior fleetingly. I mean, the one of the restaurants that kind of was the most egregious perpetrator in the series that I did, they hired someone to be their forager, their kind of farmer liaison, and this young woman was essentially just doing PR, but, you know, kind of trumpeting the farmers and that kind of thing, and they promptly fired her as soon as they felt like the heat was off of them. So, you know, I think also restaurants in particular, they operate with such narrow margins that there are times where, you know, it's just really hard to do the right thing. And it's so tempting to hedge or to, you know, greenwash a little bit, you know, buy a lot of Cisco stuff and then kind of finish off over the top with some microgreens from down the street. So it's very hard to do the right thing, especially if you're talking about a place where there's real seasonal change, because consumers don't know what is in season. We had an Olive Garden commercial recently in the state of Florida that was talking about local Gulf seafood, and the picture on the ad was a salmon that does not in any way grow. You cannot find a salmon in the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, but that reflects that people don't know, and it's easy to pull the wool over our eyes.
Has doing this investigative project, you were a food critic, you've been a food critic, did doing that investigative project change how you approach your writing?
Oh, 100%, because I felt I was part of the problem. I was blithely parroting back lies that people were telling me in my reviews. And so now I am much more skeptical, and I also frequently say prove it if people make claims. I recently did a review of a restaurant that's another restaurant from one of the chief perpetrators in the series. And they told me about this deal they had with this cattle rancher in Florida, and that they were basically raising cattle, you know, whole life cycle, and, you know, not corn finished, et cetera, for this restaurant. And I absolutely was not going to write this down, you know, until I had proof. So I had to independently find out whether they were making up tall tales. And in fact, it was completely valid. But I increasingly feel like that's part of the job. You know, food critic, like, there aren't that many of us left at major U.S. dailies. Newspapers are under, you know, critically hard times and lots of financial pressures, and it's a job that's largely gone away. But the ones of us that are left, our beats have changed, and there's a lot more investigative work and metro work and even just kind of consumer journalism that we all do. It's not so much just thumbs up, thumbs down, I think, now.
After producing this investigative series, Laura Riley decided to reveal her identity publicly instead of trying to stay undercover, as many food critics do. Alex asked her how this changed her work.
Definitely has allowed me to do some bigger stories and some more kind of deep divey stories and stories where you're kind of immersed. Earlier this year, I did a project on Florida oyster aquaculture. So Florida wild oysters have been really decimated, and the short reason for that is that the salinity of that body of water has increased dramatically in recent years. And the oysters can hack it, you know, they're pretty sturdy beasts, but what it has meant is that the predators that come in from the Gulf of Mexico now can do it 12 months out of the year, and it's just a buffet. So the wild oysters have been completely decimated. So there are all these oystermen who are essentially on the dole waiting for something to turn around that's probably never going to turn around. So meanwhile, all these young people, a lot of, you know, millennials with like marine biology degrees are like, well, let's do oyster aquaculture at the top of the water column. So it's all the apparatus sits up high. The predators can't get to it. And you can pull it in and out. I mean, it's a lot. It's the difference between hunting and farming, though. So it comes with a lot of kind of ideological differences and kind of this, you know, it's almost like this, like, you know, Crips and Bloods kind of mutual distrust kind of thing. So I love those stories where it's about disruptive technology and the culture, the interstices that happen, kind of where the old meets the new. So I did this story in Apalachicola Bay with this young guy whose family's been, you know, fourth generation oyster, you know, oyster tongers from Apalachicola Bay. And he's having to go into the next county because he can't do it there. So he goes into the next county and is doing top of the water column oyster aquaculture. And he's a little bit of a pariah, you know, in amongst his kind of longtime family and friends. So those kind of stories that are just much harder to do if you're kind of worried about who knows you.
Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Laura Riley has served as food critic for the Tampa Bay Times for nearly 11 years. Her award-winning Farm to Fable series led to nominations for a Pulitzer Prize for Criticism and a James Beard Award. Riley announced this week she'll be leaving the Tampa Bay Times for a position at the Washington Post. Find links to her work on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/bloomington.
and Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop committed to sustainable practices and organic, ethically sourced coffee from small-scale farmers, featuring handmade quiche, scones, and baked goods. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. New Year's resolutions. It's the beginning of February. If you're the type to make resolutions about eating better, you might need a little nudge right about now. Jackie B. Howard is back with instructions on how to get your day started right with a smoothie bowl.
If you're not familiar with the smoothie bowl takes a smoothie, makes it a little on the thicker side, and then you're gonna serve it like it's yogurt. So I'm just using enough butternut squash here for one smoothie bowl for myself for breakfast. That's about a cup of butternut squash. And then I'm gonna pull out of the freezer some frozen banana halves. And these are just as they get too ripe to be eating in a regular way. I freeze them. So they're gonna be extra sweet on their own, which is really nice. And then I don't have to add any sugar to my smoothie bowl other than the fruit. So I'm taking just one sort of large half of banana. I'm gonna do coconut milk today because I have pantry things that I need to be using. And canned coconut milk is one of them. And I would eyeball it to the thickness that I want. I want to control how I want this to be for myself. So I'm gonna start a little low on the coconut milk and then add to it. So I'm probably gonna start with like a quarter of a cup of coconut milk. I usually would add almond butter for these orange vegetables. This is my first time doing butternut squash as a smoothie bowl, so I'm excited about it. I've done sweet potato. I've done carrots. I really love carrot and make it like a carrot cake smoothie bowl. Pumpkin is really great. But for those vegetables, I want a little more sweetness out of it and take that like slight vegetal flavor from it. I mean, I like the way that tastes, but in breakfast, people think it needs to be a little sweeter. Smoothie, you think it needs to be a little sweeter? So I like to add almond butter to it. It gives it that like toasty baked flavor. So I'm gonna add a little of turmeric to this. I'm gonna do sort of a take on the golden milk for my smoothie. So I'm gonna add some turmeric. It's really good for you. I already have the cinnamon and such on my butternut squash. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna add just a few sprinkles. We'll say it's probably a quarter of a teaspoon of the turmeric. When you use turmeric, you want to add just a pinch of black pepper. I know that also sounds a little strange, but it helps you absorb the turmeric, those benefits from the turmeric. So I'm going to do just a tiny bit of black pepper in this as well. And that's like one crank on my grinder. And then I'm going to add some clove because I really love clove. And it's going to complement those spice flavors that I have. And then fresh ginger, just a little nub. So potent, and it adds a little spice, which is nice. And I'm just throwing that right in. Now I'm gonna blend it. So I do need more liquid in there. And I want to go through this process because I want to be able to control the exact thickness that I get to. So I'm gonna add about another quarter of a cup. That looks creamy and beautiful.
It's almost like pudding or something.
Yes. That's exactly it. And that's what's so nice. I mean, there are times I make it, I feel like I'm having pudding for breakfast. But this is vegetables. So I'm going to put this in a bowl. And this is really thick, so I really have to like pull it out of the pitcher here. And that is my personal preference. You can do them thinner. And a lot of times, so I really like to do these sorts of bases, the sweet potato, things like that. I like to do avocado ones because I want it to be thick and creamy because that's what I like. It doesn't mean, you know, a traditional, quote unquote traditional, if there's such a thing as a traditional smoothie bowl.
Yeah, this is the first time I've ever heard of one, so.
The classic, we'll say, is acai, and that's a fruit, and it usually, a lot of times people put ice in them, and it's not nearly as thick. This is the way I like to eat it. So now I'm gonna add some of those cherries. I'm gonna do coconut and granola and chia seed. You can put whatever you want on there. I've made my own granola, but I really love Muddy Fork granola. It's made locally. They have a bread oven that they cook in with wood, and it makes such a huge difference. Like the granola isn't too sweet, which is again really important to me. And the smokiness from the wood is in there, and it's so good. And it's gonna go really great with the warm flavors of my butternut squash. And I've got just flaked coconut. I could have toasted this and it would have been nice, but I kind of want the color variation.
The white is really nice against that color though.
Yeah, thanks. And the wait till the cherries go on it, it's gonna pop, they're gonna be really nice. And then I do chia seed because I really like the chia seed. Again, you could do anything, you could put anything.
Sprinkle some nuts on there if you want.
Mm-hmm. Pecans would have been really good as well. I'm really just gonna eat this right away, so there's no need to make it fancy, but it's more fun that way. And that is your smoothie bowl. Do anything that you'd like with it. Put anything you want in it. Feel good about it. It's so satisfying and filling. It'll get you through the morning. All right, so now I get to dig into this smoothie bowl. The butternut squash is so creamy. Spicy from the clove and the cinnamon. The cherries really pop on top of it against that like warm butternut squash flavor. Yeah, this is so good.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
Thank you. Thanks for hanging out with me today.
Jackie B. Howard is a regular guest on Earth Eats. She works here at WFIU and has a professional culinary background. Stay tuned for more from Jackie in the coming weeks. And as always, this recipe can be found at eartheats.org. That's all we have time for today. I'm Kate Young, and thanks for listening to Earth Eats. And thanks to everyone who helps with the show, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Laura Riley and Jackie B. Howard. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers, offering teas and signature drinks like the Hilltopper. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.